the Beef Watch Podcast. I'm Aaron Berger, a Nebraska Extension educator. For today's Beef Watch Podcast, we're going to continue our series, Understanding Methane Production in Cattle. Today's article that we're going to talk about is from the April issue of the Beef Watch newsletter, titled, How and Why is Methane in Cattle Produced? To have a conversation about the content, I'm joined today by the author, Dr. Simona Fernando, who's a rumen microbiologist in the Department of Animal Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Aaron.
Dr. Fernando, before we talk about the topic today, tell us a little more about yourself, your history, and what you're researching there as a rumen microbiologist in the Department of Animal Science.
So I joined UNL in 2012 as an assistant professor, and I've moved through the ranks. I'm a full professor right now. I got my bachelor's in University of Kalania in Sri Lanka, then joined Oklahoma State University, where I completed a master's in reproductive physiology and then a PhD in rumen microbiology. And then I went to MIT and did a postdoc at MIT on studying microbes in corals, a different field than the rumen, but some of the tools and technologies that's used in corals are the same as that's what's used in looking at microbiomes in humans and animals as well. So then I joined UNL in 2012 and has been here since then.
Talk about some of the work you're doing with rumen microbes and understanding how they operate within the ruminant, and maybe give us a little background on how the technology we have today has really enhanced our knowledge and understanding compared to where we were 10, 20 years ago.
So my research on ruminants focus on how can we manipulate the rumen microbiome to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but not just greenhouse gas emissions, but how can we improve animal well-being and productivity using the microbiome. So my research focuses partly on developing probiotics to improve animal health and productivity, but also looking at how does the microbiome assemble? Are there opportunities or windows that we can use to manipulate the rumen microbiome to increase disease resistance, increase animal performance, and even pathogen shedding? So some of our research is looking at early life colonization. Can we actually introduce good microbes early in life before a microbiome is established, so that way we can have long-term effects and impacts on the animal's health and performance? Apart from that, I also work on antimicrobial resistance. So looking at alternatives for antimicrobial resistance, such as instead of Thailand, are there certain probiotic strains of microbes that we can use, or how can we use different metabolites or feed additives to change the microbiome as well? So to answer your second question on how has the field moved and how are we able to study the microbiome now compared to 10, 15 years ago, earlier, we used to have to culture these microbes one by one and to study these microbes. But the challenge there is we don't know all the nutrient requirements of these microbes or what substrates they utilize to actually grow them one by one. So it's estimated that about 90% or 90, even more than that of the microbes, even in the rumen, has not been cultured yet. But with the sequencing technologies improving now, even if we don't have the microbes in culture, we can actually use the DNA. So we can go to the rumen, extract all the DNA in that sample, and then just randomly sequence that DNA and try to identify what genes, what microbes are there. So using these sequencing-based technologies, we've been able to understand the rumen microbiome much better than using culture-based approaches. So that's why we now have a better understanding of what are the different microbes, how much diversity is there in the rumen, and what are these microbes doing, because we can now look at genes, although we can't actually culture some of these microbes.
Talk about the complexity and diversity of the population of rumen microbes, because I think sometimes we don't grasp how deep that is in terms of the volume or the amount and also the diversity that's there.
So ruminants are unique because if you think about a monogastric animal like a pig or even humans, actually the microbes are in the hindgut. So the host enzymes actually break down the substrates and whatever leftover undigested is what microbes use. But if you think about a ruminant animal, you're actually feeding the microbes. So the rumen, which is one of the unique features that ruminants have, actually have billions of microbes, and these microbes are not just bacteria. You have bacteria, archaea, fungi, protozoa, and even viruses in the microbiome. We call them the rumen microbiome because it's a mix of different microbes in there. Bacteria obviously dominate this microbiome, but then fungi actually gain access to feed particles. They burrow in so that bacteria can go in and break down these complex carbohydrates. Then protozoa actually can also metabolize certain substrate, complex substrate, but they actually feed on microbes and actually help control some of these microbial populations. The viruses do the same thing. They actually can feed or predate on these bacterial populations, so they help control. So together, this microbiome, which is made of these complex prokaryotic and eukaryotic microbes, so two different kingdoms of different microbes, actually work together as a whole group to maintain efficiency and function within the rumen. The other group that I didn't talk so far is the archaea. Archaea are the ones that actually produce methane, and majority of the archaea inside the rumen are methanogens. So those are the ones that actually produce methane inside the rumen, but they have other metabolic functions. They can break down carbohydrates and other substrates as well, or at least intermediates of these complex carbohydrates. And as a byproduct, they produce methane. And part of our discussion today is going to focus on these methanogens, a subpopulation, only about 3%, 3 to 10% of the total microbiome, but they play a big role in terms of methane production.
Talk a little more about that, because I think, as you said, if they're only 3% of the rumen microbe or rumen microbiome, why are they so important? Can't we just get rid of them and then reduce methane production?
Great question, Aaron. But these methanogens have actually co-evolved with the host. So as long as we've seen cattle, they've actually always had these methanogens because they play an important role in increasing the efficiency of the rumen as well. So for example, if you think about the rumen is free of oxygen, so it's anaerobic. So the rumen being anaerobic, when a complex carbohydrate is broken down inside the rumen, it produces these energy-dense intermediate products called volatile fatty acids. So when you don't have oxygen, these intermediates are the ones that are absorbed by the host animal, and the host animal gets energy. So the rumen microbiome can actually provide up to about 70% of the energy of the host animal just by microbial fermentation. So as part of this fermentation, so glycolysis, so I'm going to go a little bit into biochemistry, but if there's you have questions, please stop me and I'll try to clarify further. So one of the processes that doesn't need oxygen is called glycolysis, where these glucose or these once these complex carbohydrates are broken down into monosaccharides, they get fermented into pyruvate. This pyruvate, which is the end product of glycolysis, then feeds into these VFAs or volatile fatty acids that these microbes produce in the process of producing ATP that gets absorbed and the host gets energy from them. So this process, as you produce ATP, you're also producing another molecule called NADH or nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. This NAD gets reduced to NADH in this process, but this NADH has to be re-oxidized to NAD so that this glycolysis can keep on moving forward and produce these volatile fatty acids for the host. So what the methanogens actually do is help recycle that NADH back to NAD without using energy-dense substrates, because in the absence of these methanogens, this NADH has to be recycled back to NAD or oxidized back to NAD using some of the pyruvate that's otherwise available for VFA production. So by having these methanogens, you're actually making more VFAs compared to not having methanogens, therefore making the rumen more efficient.
We hear about feed additives today, like seaweed, that can reduce methanogenesis in the ruminant. When those are introduced, how does that change what's happening, and how does that impact the efficiency of the animal to be able to use the feed resource?
So some of these seaweed or bromoform, which is the chemical compound in seaweed that is thought to affect methanogenesis, is directly affecting the methane-producing microbes, so or the methanogens. So by doing that, it's actually now have less recycling of that NADH back to NAD. So therefore, by attacking these methanogens, you are actually increasing the hydrogen concentration inside the rumen, but also making, theoretically at least, if methanogens are involved in converting NADH back to NAD, now by inhibiting these methanogens using these algal compounds or bromoform, you're reducing the recycling, which means now the rumen microbes have to find a different way to do it. And one way to do that is use some of that pyruvate that's available for VFA production or volatile fatty acid production now just to convert that NADH back to NAD, so making less ATP or less VFAs for the host animal. So we don't know the long-term effects. Many of the studies are short-term and we see a reduction in methane, but we don't know what the long-term effect on animal performance or animal well-being that these feed additives have. And that's ongoing research right now that's been done to look at what are the long-term effects of using these feed additives.
I want to change focus a little bit now and talk about some of the research that you've done looking at the microbiome, introducing desirable microbiomes into calves shortly after birth, basically inoculating the animal with the desired microbiome. Speak to that a little bit in terms of the research you're doing and the potential that may have.
So when a calf is born, they don't have a stable microbiome. Usually a ruminant animal, as a non-ruminant, when the calf is born, it takes about 100 to 120 days to have a stable microbiome and a functional rumen. So the concept is before a microbiome can be established, might be the best opportunity for us to introduce new microbes in. For example, if you think about a room, if the room is full of individuals and you come in, it's you don't have a seat unless you're strong enough to push somebody out of the seat to sit there. So you could think the same concept on a microbiome. When the microbiome is fully established, now if you introduce a microbe or even a probiotic, now that probiotic has to outperform already colonized microbes to survive in that environment. But let's think about you came early to seminar room or your lecture. Now you have enough seats that you can pick and choose and sit. The same concept. So before a rumen microbiome is colonized, if when there is open niches, open opportunities inside the rumen, if we can introduce microbes, they have a better chance of colonizing and or persisting for a long time. So based on that concept, what we are trying to do is introduce microbes early in life, and we've done studies where we've taken a cattle population and sampled them as early as 30 days after birth, because we are tubing, we can't go earlier than that. And then we've monitored these cattle all the way to the feedlot, and we can actually recover about 70% of the microbiome that we see in that 30-day-old calf when that animal is in the feedlot. So that is how we developed this concept of early life microbiome intervention. So what we've done so far is a very small pilot study where we've taken 12 animals, six on a high methane inoculum. So we took inoculum or a microbiome from animals that produce large amounts of methane, and we took another microbiome from animals that produce less amounts of methane and introduced these microbiomes to 12 calves, six for each treatment at birth within the first 24 hours. And we looked at when these calves go to the feedlot, how does their methane phenotype looks like? And what we've seen is if they got a high methane microbiome, they actually produced higher levels of methane than the animals that got the low methane microbiome. So that's showing that maybe that early life intervention, and when we monitored these microbes, we can actually see a large proportion of those microbes that we inoculated in each group was actually established as well. So sort of preliminary data is saying maybe that early life inoculum might have long-term effects. So we are trying to use this concept So we've done it on methane, but this is a concept that can broadly be used for any phenotype. If you want a high efficient animal, if you take a microbiome from a high efficient animal and introduce it into a calf, can we get a more efficient animal? If you think about dairy cattle, if you introduce a microbiome of a high milk producing animal, would that help that animal produce more milk? Even disease resistance, the same thing. If we can have resistant microbiomes, introduce them early, can we get more disease resistant animals? So we are investigating this concept of early life microbiome inoculation and how it would have long-term effects. And the other advantage is right now, if we introduce a probiotic in the feedlot, we have to feed it every day. This concept of early life inoculation might be a one-time inoculation, which has long-term effects. So for a producer, there might be some labor upfront at the beginning, but it's you don't have to feed it. So maybe feeding the feed additive every day, that cost could be decreased for the producer as well, but have long-term effects of that early life inoculation.
Dr. Fernando, as you describe this, it also brings to mind for me the cattle production system. And so much of what takes place in cattle production is they're consuming forage and converting that into meat and milk. But we also have a segment of the population, which would be steer calves, that go to a feed yard and they're on a high concentrate diet for an extended period of time. Would it be possible to tailor the microbiome to focus on maybe a microbiome that's more geared towards a high starch type diet versus a high fiber energy type diet?
Yes, so that's a very valid question because our production system, we go through high forage diets and then high starch diets. So one way to approach that could be that Inoculum could have a mixture of a high forage and a high starch microbiomes mixed together. So we can pull from those two. So when we introduce early in life, we have those fiber digesting microbes, but also the starch digesting microbes as well. And the other thing we've seen is actually there is a core set of microbes that we see that whether they are on a forage-based diet or a starch-based diet, this core set of microbes always are there stable. For example, in one of our studies, we took the Inoculum from feedlot animals for this that methane trial that I just mentioned, and we introduced a microbiome on a high starch into these calves, but they were actually grazing till weaning. And what we saw was even about, I'd say, 75% of the Inoculum was establishing in these grazing animals, suggesting that even in your high starch diet, there is a lot of fiber digesting microbes as well. So, a great question. One way would be to mix the Inoculum to have those microbes, but at least our data so far is showing that there's a core set of microbes that can actually adapt into using forage-based diets as well as starch-based diets.
How do you identify your desired core-based microbes? What's the process to do that so you see this is what we want or this is what we prefer not to have? What's the process to accomplish that?
So that's where we spend most of our time, Aaron, because if you have a microbiome, if you don't have a phenotype, what I mean by phenotype is this microbiome associated with a disease-resistant animal or a disease-susceptible animal to disease, or with a high-producing methane or low-producing methane? That microbiome has no meaning. So, biggest thing we do is we actually phenotype lots of animals to see, okay, when we have a microbiome from that animal, what's that animal's phenotype in terms of, let's say, methane? Is it a high methane or a low methane producing animal? So that way we can phenotype hundreds or even thousands of animals to see. And when we study the microbiome, we can look at stably what microbes do we see in all these high methane animals, or what microbes do we see in these low methane animals? And that's how we decide how to make those microbiomes. Most of the time, the microbiome or the Inoculum doesn't come from a single animal because there is a lot of animal-to-animal variation in the microbiome. For example, if you and I look at our microbiomes, they're going to be very different from each other. But maybe functionally, they are much closer than taxonomically what different species are there. So the way we approach that is we phenotype or look at the phenotype microbiome pairing for a lot of animals to identify these are the animals that have the right phenotype, the desired phenotype, and they all carry similar microbiomes. But then we actually use a pooled sample rather than an individual sample when it comes to inoculation, so that we sort of account for that animal-to-animal variation as well.
Dr. Fernando, what else would you like folks to know about the work that you're doing and how it impacts methane production in beef cattle?
So I know we talked a lot about how to manipulate a microbiome. So my research is focused on how can we develop new strategies or novel strategies to improve ruminant health and nutrition while reducing methane emissions, so we can have a sustainable agricultural system. So for me, feedback from producers and feedback from our key stakeholders is important, because that helps me find what are the critical questions and how can I help with my expertise to answer those, or find strategies to answer those. So for me, feedback from key stakeholders is important, but I'm here to help answer questions, and my research is more basic, but I also have an applied approach, or like the early life colonization experiments or producing probiotics. So my research is focused on applications, but I use a lot of basic research and basic science to sort of develop new approaches to help producers and stakeholders.
Dr. Fernando, thanks for your time today and for the work that you're doing. I think it's opening up an area of research and also opportunity that we in the past have really not considered or understood. And so I think it's an exciting time, and looking forward to seeing what you learn and also how we might use this technology as we think about, as you said, a production system for cattle that is effective and efficient and uses resources well.
Thank you very much for your time, Aaron, and it was nice visiting with you as well.
For more information on the topic that we talked about in today's Beef Watch podcast, you can find the article at beef.unl.edu. The title of the article, How and Why is Methane in Cattle Produced? Also, if you'd like to visit directly with Dr. Simoto Fernando, his contact information is at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln Animal Science Department website.